Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by an absolute tidal wave of wisdom and venerability, and of course that is Mr. Terence Corrigan. How are you, Terence?
I'm okay, Nicholas, and yourself?
I'm all right, thank you. And the other half of that tidal wave is, of course, Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Fine, thanks very much. I'm very glad that my Scottish dog is to be let out of the behind me.
Yes, I hope
not too much fuss. But I heard a crisis developing. he wanted to go.
Yeah, hopefully he won't bark during the show. And
indeed, I think he's gone away, so it's fine. Yeah. Otherwise, perfectly well. Thanks.
Excellent. All right, let me start first with a quick word from our sponsor, who's once again Bitvice. And so Bitvice says that Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African first Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should own their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have, of course, been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your Bitcoin wallet, where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. And thanks very much to them for sponsoring us once again. So let us get into the news of the day. Probably the most important story that's come out today is the latest quarterly GDP figures. So that's essentially a good indicator of how the economy is doing. Oh, I just see the stage two load shedding's been announced. Oh, isn't that wonderful? So according to these figures, the economy has contracted slightly, being down by 0.7% from what it was last quarter. This is apparently, according to some of the reporting on this, very slightly better than expected. There was a contraction of around 0.8% expected due to occasional floods, load shedding, that kind of stuff. Some of the sectors that got hit worst, manufacturing shrank by 5.9%, particularly related to damages in KZN because of the big floods there. Agriculture decreased by 7.7%. Mining and the quarrying industry shrunk by 3.5%. There's also was a little bit of growth in some sectors, particularly, I think, finance and real estate, which have continued to be the sort of only, I wouldn't call them thriving, but healthy parts of the SA economy over the last couple of years that are making this not as bad as it could be. If you compare it, if you annualize this, I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but I believe that it's pretty flat from what it was last year. So it looks like there hasn't been that much growth over the last year. And if you adjust for inflation, which of course has been going up around the world, there's a little bit of growth going around, but really not great figures here. Terence, what's your big takeaway from this? I mean, the news reporting is putting a lot of the blame here once again on floods and things, but that's surely not the whole story.
Floods, pandemics, lockdowns, and multi-decade retardation. If you go back to the global financial crisis, what's 2008, 2009? South Africa never recovered from that. That's your starting point. I think it was 2006 and 2007, South Africa's economy grew in excess of 5%. That's the only time post-1994 that happened. If we had been able to maintain that sort of growth, we'd be in an exponentially different and exponentially better position. One can't exclude the damage that pandemics and those floods had, but the economy has just been in a funk. And as I say, I think the appropriate phrase is long-term retardation. Interesting as this comes out yesterday, the president was telling us that there are signs of cautious optimism. So, you know, we're starting to turn around. Well,
wasn't it
day too soon?
And the finance minister wrote that article where he said signs of recovery are imperceptible, but they are there.
Yeah. And then on Sunday there was something in the press about how the economy was approaching a point where it's almost unfixable. Talking about things like the localization strategies, the idea that government can sort of dictate to firms how much they invest, who they hire, as though this is some sort of checkerboard where you can shift your pieces around, but you don't only have to go forward; you can go back as well. You know that rules of such inanities as supply and demand don't really apply.
No, indeed, and of course this is the ANC loves to blame the global environment for economic woes, and of course sometimes they are right. The only problem is I think they continue to blame the global environment. I remember through the whole of the 2010s, as the rest of the world recovered from the 2008 crisis, just as I was becoming politically aware, it was very interesting to note that lots of government officials were continuing to blame the fallout of the financial crisis and the difficult global environment years after the rest of the world seems to have bounced back from it. And of course, the other lesson is that if you don't have a strong economy in the good times, when the bad times come, you've got no fat to live off of. And of course, there's also speculation that this may even get a little bit worse. The Reserve Bank has had to increase its rates to compete, to make us favorable in comparison to the US and Europe, which have been hiking their rates, their interest rates, and that may make it harder to buy, to borrow, and start new businesses and that kind of thing. Michael, what do you make of all this?
We
have this conversation so often, unfortunately, but this is the unfortunate reality of economic policy in South Africa, right? We are stuck in this Groundhog Day scenario.
Exactly, and you know, as Terence points out, it's in the context that we're very familiar with, which makes it all the more maddening, really. I mean, you're mentioning the load shedding, a little note at the start of your introducing this item, that, you know, load shedding is about to begin. That's another one, and we're issuing in fact, I think it's gone out, a press statement this afternoon. Our head of campaigns, Gabriel Krause, has issued a press statement highlighting this economic data, but pointing out how it's aligned in a sense with what events in Parliament next week, where the latest iteration of the expropriation legislation is going to be coming before MPs, and it's very likely that it will be passed. And here is a law which, as Gabriel points out, it's anti-profit policy. It's an anti-profit policy of EWC will succeed in driving down profit, shrinking productivity further, and therefore driving away the new investments that would otherwise have provided opportunities to the unemployed. So, you know, this is front and center of exactly what our problem is. And to talk about imperceptible but nevertheless real improvements or signs of hope and so on, while pressing on with this, is just a flat contradiction that simply doesn't make sense. And this in a country also, I mean, every day almost, I'm reminded of how enormously resourceful and hardworking and innovative the South African private sector is. Just as one example, my wife happens to be up in Beaufort at the moment on a family matter, and as a treat for us via the internet, she arranged delivery of some goodies from a wine farm, a very good wine farm out in the Cape Flat, out in the Cape Winelands, and it all works seamlessly. There's, you know, it's transported here, the order goes through, the banking system works, it's all painless, it's efficient. This is the kind of country we are, but it's on such a small and limited scale precisely because of the policy environment in which businesses are having to operate. So it is a crying shame.
Right. The only people who seem to be making money right now are those in finance. I think that your story there attests to the surprising health of our finance industry, you know, despite kind of everything else going on.
Mm. And people in other sectors who are really working hard and, you know, pulling out all the stops to make things work and to do business, to keep employing people, keep food on the table. So there are these, you know, but it's kind of limited success precisely because there's so much being piled on top of them. In taxes, bad policy, and all the rest of it.
And you know, sort of finance is a kind of industry where, you know, kind of more skilled, middle-classy people are likely to find jobs. You're not going to get people who have never been employed before getting their first job in finance, at least except on quite a limited level. So, you know, that means that those people who might have got a job in a factory or might have got a job on a farm or might have got a job in a mine are not in a good place, or on a construction site. The horrifying statistic included in this is that construction industry is 24% smaller than it was before the pandemic, which is crazy. So we've lost a quarter of the whole construction industry.
Yeah.
Parents, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
One would think that this is that this sort of thing should be a wake-up call, but I suspect next year we'll be having the same conversation.
No, indeed. I just
don't think that the authorities, as they are currently constituted in South Africa, have the depth of political imagination to conceive of anything different. If you remember that reality show MythBusters, wonderful line at the beginning: "I reject your reality and substitute my own."
Yes. We were talking yesterday about the Conservative Party in the UK and how it's, you know, it's got some problems because it's been in power for so long and the party has run out of ideas. Well, it's been in power since 2010, I think. That's 12 years. And I think the ANC has literally doubled the problem, which is that every solution is the same solution that we tried last time, but we're just going to do it harder this time. Hence, you get the expropriation bill. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on this one, but just some thoughts that you had, Michael, on this one. We covered a while ago on the show that Kenya was having an election and how things looked pretty good because that country had come out of a dark period where there was a lot of violence after one of their disputed elections. Well, the election was very close, but it was won by former Deputy President William Ruto. But the opposition said there was cheating and took it to the Supreme Court of Kenya. And Kenya's Supreme Court has in the past overturned elections. And so it was all getting very dramatic. There were some riots. It looked like Kenya might fall back into chaos. But after a ruling by the Supreme Court, a unanimous ruling saying that all of its saying that there was no real evidence of cheating that could have changed the result, and that William Ruto was indeed the president-elect, there was a lot of grumbling from the current president, who was a supporter of the opposition, and from the opposition themselves, who said, "We vehemently disagree with this court ruling, but we will abide by it." And it looks like Kenya is going to have a peaceful transition of power after all. And Michael, you had some thoughts on this.
One of the things I was thinking about was, you know, how important the conduct of politics is, rather than necessarily the content of politics. But we've just a moment ago been actually contradicting that by asserting how important policy is. But I think I still think there's something interesting happening there, an interesting dynamic, and it's Terence highlights this, where one is talking about that fundamental inability to confront what reality is and to kind of agree on a very basic framework of what is real. And I think to that extent, what I'm saying is something that might hold true here too, that a lot of our policy arises from the way we do politics, which is irrational and based on a kind of terrible unreality. So it's always encouraging when you see political parties or political leaders responding in this way, accepting the reality, accepting results, and, you know, conducting their politics in a politic way, to coin a phrase. The immediate thought that I had this morning was thinking of Boris Johnson's farewell speech, I know he's a problematic fellow, but I've always quite liked him because he's a bit of a maverick and his hair's all over the place and he's a classicist and, you know, there are all kinds of reasons why he's quite sort of likable. He seems a bit naughty and there's always something quite about him. But you know, here's a chap who's, you know, the politics will go on. I don't know if he's, we were chatting a bit before the show about quite whether he was being entirely truthful to say that he can't be like Cincinnati and go back to his power, whether it's going to be as simple as that. But, you know, it's kind of a very human figure, talks about the pets at Downing Street. It's quite a witty remark about his dog, Dylan, managing to put these differences aside with the Downing Street cat, Larry. And he suggested that if Dylan and Larry could put their differences behind them, then surely the factions of the Conservative Party could do the same. So, you know, it's a much more palatable scenario, I think. That
no, I think your point is exactly right, that you know, politics is—it's about policy, but it's also about following the rules, accepting things, and fitting within this framework of good governance and democracy and respect for the institutions. And the Brits are particularly good at that. You know, they resign, for example, when they do things that are wrong. I think. William Kesey is the only politician of ours who has resigned any time recently. That I can think of without sort of being forced out. And even then, you know, he was facing pretty damning evidence of corruption as well. So, Terence, any thoughts on this before we move on?
Look, it's the journey to democracy across Africa has been a very torturous one. It's encouraging to see this. But I think another lesson from the recent history of the continent is that there is a there have been a lot of false starts. It takes a great deal of effort to get to a point where your democracy or your constitutional order is worthy of the name. And I think sort of credit to Kenya that there've been stops and starts and regressions and progress, but they have something to celebrate.
Yes,
and I think that sometimes we can be somewhat blithe about believing in the resilience of South Africa's of South African democracy. It remains a work in progress.
Indeed. And I think there are important lessons for South Africans to take from a country like Kenya for when we inevitably have our change of political power, whether that be in 2024, 2029, or sometime after. That day will come. And on that day, it's going to be very important for people to get involved to make sure that the system works as it should. Anyway, let us go on to our last story here, which is second last story, which is I'm not quite sure how to categorize this story, but it did catch my eye. So there is quite an outcry in KZN after the police decided they were going to do a raid, essentially, of the school. According to the Department of Education, this is a fairly common practice in some schools where they have major crime problems, where the police occasionally will come in to search for weapons, drugs, and in this case as well, cell phones. This particular school had a policy that said that there were no cell phones allowed by students on school premises, and so a lot of cell phones were confiscated by the police during their search and seizure operation at the school. This did not go down well with the students. Apparently, the students reacted violently and proceeded to vandalize large parts, many of the classrooms in the school, as well as set fire to some of them and burn them down, which is, of course, completely wild, much more exciting than my high school. But anyway, The KZN Education MEC, Bali Fraser, said, "We applaud the work of the police and we are encouraged to see that our agreement with SAFS is bearing fruit, but we are outraged at the behavior of these students." The DA condemned it, and just all around, there was a lot of hand-wringing and freaking out about this. But it highlights this problem that we do have, I think, in South Africa, which is that, you know, we don't have great respect for the rule of law, and it starts pretty early on, I think, in our kind of cultural inculcation. Michael, what lessons do you think we should take from this?
I mean, the first thing that strikes me is the KwaZulu-Natal Education Department obviously don't know anything about teenagers, for whom the only motto, I think, is "Don't touch me on my cell phone." I think to separate teenagers from cell phones these days is, it's just a bit silly almost, in a way. You know, it's just, I mean, I know that schools that I'm aware of here in Cape Town, cell phones are, in fact, have become integral to their, to the way they're taught and are updated with, you know, material from teachers and communications from classroom groups and so on. So, yeah, I mean, I can understand. And, you know, to see a teenager without a phone for an hour is to see a hugely frustrated and completely lost individual who feels as if, you know, the world has come to an end. So I do understand the sentiment. But, yes, this is no excuse for the kind of behavior that we see there. I think you're right. There is the sense that we can just get away with stuff. You often see it in the traffic. I'm sure Cape Town is no different from other parts of the country, but I'm often struck by how people will drive as if the only reason to judge whether or not to do something is whether you can do it, whether it's physically possible to do it. Whether it's against the rules of the road is neither here nor there. And I think you see quite a lot of that right away across society. And this is certainly an example, I'm sure, where if you get angry enough about something, you feel you have permission to act out, to take whatever revenge you feel is justified.
Right. And school burning in particular has become a bit of a, I don't know what word to use for it, a meme, a habit. I think around large parts of South Africa.
Yeah.
Terrence, how do we solve some of these problems? Because, you know, you can make the police force work better, and I'm sure that's part of the solution. But if people are determined to not follow the rules, then all you're going to get is the police clashing with people all the time. How do you think that we begin to rebuild this sort of faith in the system and respect for law and order?
That's a tough one. I think that what you're dealing with here, sort of in a sense comparable to our economic malaise, is that you're talking about social dislocation that's generations and generations old now. I would say that if you want to go back into South Africa's history and pick out one sin that has defined our present and, you know, is the most indictable one, I wouldn't say it's necessarily the racial discrimination or anything, as bad as that was, the denial of the franchise, but I think it is the disruption to the African family structure through things like migrant labor. I remember Agri Claster, the one-time editor of Sowetan, saying that the great tragedy of South African history is that we had strong families, whether they were of the European type or the African type or the Asian type. And these were sort of torn apart. I remember actually speaking to an African gentleman some years ago, and he said, you know, you can imagine what somebody who comes from a position of some status in a traditional community to go and work on a mine, is paraded naked, and it's very humiliating. Can't have his family with him. What that does to that sort of psychology, living not within a family unit, but, you know, with lots of other testosterone fueled men, very frustrated, etc. While children, you know, lack the influence of
Right, particularly boys growing up without fathers.
Yeah.
There's quite a lot of social science to suggest that leads to violence. Yeah,
people, children being raised in single parent families, but not, because the mom and dad had an amicable divorce and sort of share them on weekends. That I think differentiates South Africa from many of its peers across the continent. It's not the extent of poverty. It's not the lack of social services. It's the lack of it's the lack of a mediating social social structure. And I don't know what how we deal with that. In Nigeria, for instance, where you have pretty effectively, in many respects, a failed state. And I've spoken to people who say that they're okay with their kids going out in the village and playing and coming back when it's dark, because they know that the community enforces its own norms and standards, and children are seen as a kind of common responsibility. Now, it's possible to romanticize that, but there are certain red lines you don't cross. Nigeria is hopelessly corrupt, but there's an interesting dynamic that apparently you mess with the village funds at your peril. Taking billions and billions from the trade account is one thing, but the sort of $10 that the community has contributed, you don't. And I think it's also been perhaps pushed along by a sort of cult of authenticity, the idea that you have that you have rights without responsibilities, that there are certain material goods that to which you have some sort of inalienable right, once again in the absence of responsibilities. I don't know. The best answer I can come up with at short notice is that those of us who carry some sort of responsibility need to do a much better job of setting an example.
I agree with that completely. I think that's part of it. A problem like this, I think, is really difficult to solve. It can take sometimes even generations, because it took, in many ways, generations to do the damage in the first place. It probably starts with improving the police force so it works, with getting economic growth going, with providing people with those alternative paths other than, joining a gang, burning down schools, hustling for a living, whatever it is. But that's not the whole story. There also has to be some kind of sort of social cultural push as well to get people, and especially kids, back onto the right path. And that is one where you add value to society rather than taking it away. Michael, final thoughts on this?
I absolutely agree. I so often hear people motivated by all kinds of things, some of it racism, doubtless, but also perhaps even a genuine sense of inquiry, asking about our blacks, about South African black people compared to people from Zimbabwe or Malawi or Nigeria and so on. And the thing that I always try to emphasize or raise as a question, like Terence, it's really a question of asking, of saying, one doesn't really know for sure what the answer is, but there are things to consider, is the fact that we have a very different history, and it is a history in which that esteem was eroded to an extent that was not true of so many other countries in the continent, and those structures of prestige and of authority were just completely shattered by economic need. The things that people had to do just to survive, they had to abandon all the certainties of the social structure and so on, or it was taken away from them. And I think it had a very, very great, impact on people. And then, of course, through the struggle years, I think there was also a very strong sense that any figure of authority or any symbol of authority was also the enemy. It was a legitimate target. It was something to be discounted or destroyed or taken from. And I think we still live with a kind of hangover of that kind of mentality. So
the 80s style of rioting is lives on in our service delivery process.
Indeed. Today. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, just on that, I remember reading, this was about a decade ago, that school inspectors were expelled from most township schools in the 1980s. They've never been back.
Right.
You know, what may begin as a political process becomes institutionalized, and then people start to find benefit in that.
Yeah.
No, very much so. Anyway, food for thought. But that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the show. Please like the video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please leave us good reviews if you're listening to us on the podcast apps. And we will, of course, see you tomorrow on Daily French Churches, everyone.